From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's the end of an era for Michigan State football under head coach Mark D'Antonio.
The timing was the shock for everybody, including coaches on his own staff, players in his locker room, and administrators.
Today on Stateside, we round up news of the week, including D'Antonio's departure and Detroit's lawsuit against three big landlords. Also, the city's new chief storyteller talks about taking back the narrative.
Storytelling is not a new concept. It's just been packaged into something that's cute. Stories are how we tell our histories. It's how we connect to people.
And a couple of Michigan critics review film picks from 2019, including the Oscar underdog Parasite.
When it came out, people loved it. It's just, I think people were kind of starving a little bit for something weird and offbeat like that.
All that and more on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's program, we're going to hear writing from Michigan's own Desiree Cooper. She's been living in Virginia with her two parents, both of whom are dealing with Alzheimer's.
I am a very type A person, and that has been slapped out of me in the last 3 years.
But first, hey, are you still hanging in there? What a week it has been. Between the State of the Union address, the impeachment vote, the governor's budget plan, and so much more, you could be forgiven for missing a few pretty big stories this week. So with us for a somewhat sporting news roundup are John Neo, Detroit News sports columnist, and Bill Shea, who reports on sports business for The Athletic. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, same.
So the shoe dropped this week. Michigan State University's beloved football coach Mark D'Antonio announced his retirement. Not a huge surprise, but can you remind us what makes the timing of this so interesting? John, you want to start?
It's February, and the coaching carousel has largely halted in college football, and now it's spinning again, at least in East Lansing, which is, I think that back in November, Mark D'Antonio, there have been lots of questions you mentioned. It's not a complete shock. There's been speculation that he was nearing the end and was asked about it in November when coaches start to really think about these sort of things. And he said, no, he planned to stick around for another season at least. December came, the bowl game came and went, the end of the season. And it had been radio silence until just this week. And that's, I think, the timing was the shock for everybody, including coaches on his own staff, players in his locker room, and administrators.
It was so close to signing day.
Yeah, it was the day before National Signing Day. So the timing, I think, struck everybody as not just awkward, but strange. And that just set forth what is probably going to be a strange process now as they look for a new coach.
Right. With D'Antonio's recruiting director, Curtis Blackwell, continuing an ongoing lawsuit, he says that D'Antonio and the program committed NCAA violations. Bill, how close do you think the Hounds are to D'Antonio's heels?
And, you know, I think we're going to see in the next few months how this is going to play out. By staying as long as he did, he got, I think it was a $4.3 million bonus. So I guess from a personal financial standpoint, I understand that. I really think as the court cases and such play out, we'll have a better sense, I think, in the first half of this year. But definitely we will get a sense of what's going to happen. And it really does, my personal take on this is there's going to be another shoe that drops with this whole thing. I'm not sure what that might be.
The lawsuit, maybe.
With the lawsuit. And, you know, Michigan State Athletics for several years now has been in a very uncomfortable national spotlight. So I'm really not surprised, unfortunately, by anything anymore out of East Lansing.
Well, some would say if you don't have NCAA violations in your program, you may not actually have an NCAA program. And John, what's your take on that? How serious are the charges that Blackwell brought up by comparison to some other things we've seen?
Well, they're still a bit vague and threatening, but not entirely played out, I guess, if you would call it that. I think a lot of folks are left sort of scratching their heads, though, wondering why Michigan State hasn't settled that case. It's been, you know, sort of a steady drip of bad publicity, some fairly damning accusations that, the recruit from 2016 who was later found guilty of sexual assault and is in jail now was a guy that Mark D'Antonio almost single-handedly, it seems, brought in, insisted on bringing in. But then there's, as Bill mentioned, there does feel like there could be more to this, and it's a case that Curtis Blackwell has now brought in a lawyer, Tom Mars, who's a well-known attorney who's been involved in lots of other cases, including, among other things, essentially bringing down Ole Miss's football program with NCAA violations and a coach fired. So I think there are certainly signs that there's more to this, and how much of it comes out. I mean, this is a case that's proceeding towards possible trial, but right now is more lawyers arguing back and forth at this point.
John, Bill, you're both Detroit guys. This week, the city of Detroit took some landlords to court, a trio of real estate investors who the city says stand among the most notorious, their word, slumlords. It looks like a lot of the properties in question were in foreclosure and bought at auction. There's nothing illegal about that, of course, but the city says the issue is that these owners have been buying properties, renting them in just dreadful conditions since they don't have the money to fix them up right away. I wanted to ask, Bill, maybe how have you seen foreclosure and speculation change the city?
Well, there's obviously the national comeback narrative for Detroit. You know, we all know what Detroit's reality and reputation was for so many decades, and then improvement began. And I think because there was interest in people looking at, hey, you know, there's opportunities now in Detroit, you know, the infamous, you know, hey, come buy a house for a dollar, that sort of thing. When you get that sort of speculation and in interest, it brings a lot of unsavory characters often, you know, to the situation. And I think Detroit is fairly unique in the United States in having just absolutely astounding numbers of properties available. And you know, it's easy to, you know, cheap cash. It was easy to gobble up these properties. It's expensive to maintain them. Going back to that infamous, you know, hey, buy a house for a buck in Detroit. Well, you may be able to buy a house for a buck, but it may need $250,000 worth of fixes to bring it up to, you know, just the very most basic living standards, you know, to protect it from weather and bring it up to code. That's an expensive proposition, and people discover that, hey, I don't have the financial capability to do this. And some people just don't care. I can't speak on behalf of this trio, but, you know, I think it's an important issue that Detroit has to take care of, because part of the ongoing narrative with this city is cleaning up the blight, the slums that have been allowed to happen for a variety of reasons. You know, there's been progress over the years. You know, I lived downtown for a long time, and I see the vast acres of what are now basically urban prairies, mm-hmm. where the housing has been torn down, and a lot more of that needs to happen. Or people need to fix up what they own. That's just, you know, it's good for everyone when that happens.
So why hasn't the city gone after the Illiches? Aren't they slumlords of a different kind?
Well, go ahead, John.
No, I was just about to say the same thing. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of residents in the city that would say, well, that's fine. There's certainly these three guys who have whatever it is, 1,000 properties to their names. That's a problem. But so is the fact that you have a billionaire who has really run roughshod over city ordinances and everything else. I mean, certainly the Illich operation has been ticketed many, many times for sitting on properties that have been vacant for years and years and speculating themselves. So, I think there is a disconnect there in terms of what's illegal and what's hailed as development.
Yeah, and this is a case of, you know, small potatoes guys who might have 1,000 properties. Right. The Illich family is enormously powerful. They're political donors. I mean, they're billionaires. And they have built up a lot of goodwill with a certain segment of the population because of the success. There's a success that's now more distant in the past of their hockey and baseball teams. And the pizza company obviously has been extremely successful. And it's politically a little harder to go after folks like that. They're not universally demonized. It's a lot easier to go after a Matty Maroon, who really doesn't have any mm-hmm. cheerleaders in the community.
Right.
And his well-deserved reputation as a slumlord on both sides of the Detroit River. And the Illiches, you know, their speculation was to build mostly the District Detroit, and that really hasn't happened like they promised. So, and they're a bit more in the crosshairs than they've been in the past. So I'm really curious to see how things will play out with them.
Do you think that's because of people talking about them more and just sort of identifying them as being part of the problem?
I think absolutely. You know, before I left Cranes, we did a big piece, I think it was last March, looking at the absolute lack of progress on the district. I mean, they did build a great arena. Mm-hmm. They got a lot of tax dollars to help out with that. But, you know, we showed people, hey, here's what they promised in 2012. These gleaming, gorgeous drawings of a bustling downtown, and here today, here's the pictures of the parking lots. And there's some really nice parking lots, but that's not what they promised to build for everybody. Parking lots make money, but the stuff that they promised to build also makes money. You know, apartments and bars and restaurants, and they said they would do it, and they did not. And I think there's been increasing public pressure because of the journalism. That a lot of people have done over the last several years and hopefully will continue to do.
Parking lots also don't drink lead-tainted water. They don't have tenants to do those things. And I think that's, I guess, not to make light of this, but that's the other difference, is that they've just got a lot of vacant properties.
Yeah. Well, before we go, Kansas City just celebrated its first Super Bowl win. I mean, the Lions ever be there, too? Yeah,
you had to go there, didn't you?
I did.
No, the drumbeat's getting louder, right? I mean, the Cubs won a World Series. Cleveland, Bill's beloved Cleveland, won an NBA title a few years ago. Washington celebrated both an NHL and a Major League Baseball title.
I mean,
so it's Detroit's turn.
Who's left in the NFL who hasn't been there?
I can tell you the Detroit Lions, the Cleveland Browns, the Jacksonville Jaguars, and the Houston Texans. Two of those teams are, you know, in the last 20 years
expansion teams, right?
Yeah. It's you know, but I think I call it the Book of Revelations Apocalypse Bowl. The Browns and the Lions meeting for the first time in the Super Bowl,
right.
And there's no winner. They just keep playing forever and ever and ever. Then the world dies of when the sun explodes.
That is absolutely how I felt with the Indians and the Cubs a couple of years
ago.
Right. I can't even think about it.
I was former Clevelander, right there with you, Bill. I was dying. Well, Bill Shea, sports business reporter for The Athletic, and John Neo, sports columnist for the Detroit News. Guys, next year in Jerusalem.
There we go. Sounds good.
Great.
In just a minute, we preview this weekend's Academy Awards.
I try to tell people that the Oscars are almost never about the year itself or about the specific movies. It is kind of a cumulative process.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's almost impossible to be truly ready for Oscar weekend without taking a major chunk out of your December to watch the barrage of last-minute releases. But we're trying, because we're just about to dive in on the films nominated for this year's Academy Awards, plus the ones that should have made the cut. The awards are going to be handed out this Sunday. Our guests are Corey Hall, a writer and comedian whose work can be found in the Detroit Metro Times and WDET, and Michelle Kisner. She writes for SpoilerFreeMoviesSleuth.com and also co-hosts the site's podcast. I went over the Detroit Film Critics Society nominations. Mm-hmm. It's an organization that you're both part of.
Yes.
It was interesting to me that there were definitely exceptions. The nomination of Lupita Nyong'o for Best Actress in Us, which was just a huge performance for her last year. And the elimination of Joker, which didn't get nominated for anything, I think, by the critics. That list did not look radically different. There were lots of noms for The Irishman, lots of nominations for Noah Baumbach's film. Is the Oscar problem an issue of the Academy or an issue with the way most of us treat film?
Well, the Academy is definitely to blame, and it is certainly an older skewing demographic. I think a lot of older voters who are sticking around and have been voting for the Oscars for decades continue to get screeners. They continue to get ballots. So it's a gradual process. But I don't know. Since they've expanded the Best Picture category to 10 nominees or 9 or 10, depending, it's been great for a lot of films that would not have been considered previously. But there's always going to be something that falls through the cracks.
If these films are supposed to speak to some kind of zeitgeist, then I guess we're truly in a murder clown World War Hollywood nostalgia sad white people moment. Yes. In the United States. One film.
So a gathering of the juggalos is what is really right. 2020 America.
Tell me about a film that the Academy liked that you also enjoyed. Well, I guess we could talk about Parasite.
Yeah, Parasite.
For those who didn't see this, it is available on the streaming services right now. Michelle, I know this was a special favorite of yours.
Yes.
Could you explain the premise?
It's in Korea, and there are two families, the Kims and the Parks. The Kims are all out of jobs. They are kind of like hustling, I guess is the term you could use for that. They all have these skills that they have, but the economics of their area is not supporting them actually having jobs. So they find an inn at a estate of the Parks, who are affluent people, and they basically con their way into their household by eliminating the people that work there and taking their jobs. But the Parks don't know that all the Kims are related to each other. So it's like this thing where they're trying to hide the fact that they all know each other, but basically they're the parasite of the title. They're, you know, gleaning their wealth from the Parks.
There are two families coming together in such a way that one family has no idea what's going on.
Yes.
And there's beautiful art direction in this film, mm-hmm. but it is a feast of performances. I was going nuts over the actor who played the father of the Kim family, Kang mm-hmm. Ho-sung. I could watch him all day. He's like a merry-go-round broke down in terms of his face and his delivery.
Yeah, from top to bottom, the whole cast is stellar and believable. And also, since we're not generally familiar with these Korean actors in the United States,
yeah.
it really creates a full immersion in this story, and it's a wonderful film.
I do like that it is opening doors for more foreign films to get a distribution. I think this happened with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where it was a foreign film that it appealed to a mass audience, and then so there was this big rush after that film came out for everybody to like grab, you know, other foreign films in that same vein. And I feel like Parasite will also inspire such a thing, which is, regardless of the one's opinion of the quality of the film, it's a good thing that it gets more foreign films available for people to see in a theater.
Parasite delivers some painful truth about the disconnect between the upper class and people in working class life. I mean, not that it needs to be, but could you see this film get remade in America? Do you think that the message is that resonant with what's happening right now?
Oh, I probably guarantee it'll get remade yeah. in America. Oh. And I hope people don't have to have a remake to get it contextualized, because while there are some cultural cues that we might not really pick up on in Parasite, I know we've talked about this, that
yes.
we both watched it, and maybe some of the jokes we're not quite getting, mm-hmm. the overall impact of the film is not lessened at all. You get the immediacy
yeah.
of the story.
Noah Baumbach's drama Marriage Story also got a lot of attention. This
yes.
is a film starring Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver as a couple that's splitting up. The Detroit film critics and the Academy both like this one a lot, and it tackles themes that Baumbach has been at before, divorce and its effect on couples and families. What made this one stand out?
It was the performances, at least for me. It felt very human and relatable, even if their situation around them isn't perhaps as relatable. Like, we're not all, like, you know, like in the arts.
Stage and, directors in New York.
Yeah.
And film actresses.
I mean, if you remove their environment, I think every single person has been in a relationship that has been troubled like that, where you love somebody, but it's falling apart and you can't stop it. And you're both, like, you know, just trying to keep something together that maybe shouldn't be together. That part's relatable. If you just remove the environment from it, then it's 100% anybody can relate to a relationship going sour.
Yeah. Corey, did you enjoy this one?
I did. I think maybe the response to it is because it's a sad story.
Yeah.
It doesn't resolve in the way, and I think critics tend to grade on a curve and go, ooh, that didn't do exactly what I thought it was going to do, mm-hmm. so I'm excited about it. I will say my favorite part of Marriage Story are the supporting performances. Laura Dern is fabulous. Ray Liotta, or whatever that face is now that doesn't look like Ray Liotta.
playing just a shark-like divorce
and
attorney.
And Alan Alda. Who is, of course, always wonderful. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Alan Alda's just like butter on a warm scone. He's delightful.
Guys, is it weird that the Academy didn't give Robert De Niro a nomination for The Irishman?
I would say, I think, maybe, because it seems like, you know, everybody loved The Irishman, and he's in it the most.
Well, I wouldn't say everybody.
I mean, I wasn't a fan of it either, to be honest, but I feel like if you were going to award somebody from that film, he did a good job at what he was given to do. It seemed a little like a snub.
I try to tell people that the Oscars are almost never about the year itself mm-hmm. or about the specific movies. It is kind of a cumulative process. So I think this year, Quentin Tarantino and Scorsese, who had earlier in their careers when they were really vital, been kind of overlooked.
It just made making explosive films at the time.
Now they say, with two films that are not the best of their careers for either one of them, I think it's fair to say. I mean, I'm not slamming these films, but they're not Pulp Fiction or Raging Bull.
Right.
Then suddenly now the Academy goes, oh, well, what about the Scorsese guy? Is he worth looking into? And with De Niro, they've also been there with him before. Mm-hmm. You sort of get your opportunities, and there's a limit to how many times they're going to reward you.
I don't want to put you two on the spot for the entire Detroit Critics Society, but I noticed that one of the films that got a lot of Oscar nominations, Joker, did not get any out of the group. What did you guys think of it?
Well, I actually didn't dislike it. It's serviceable. I thought Joaquin Phoenix, I hope I'm saying his name right, did a fantastic performance. It's a really good performance that's surrounded by a mediocre film. Mm. I liked the musical score, which actually was a female composer, and I'll mess her name up, but she also did the music for Chernobyl that was on HBO, and that was really good. But other than that, I thought the movie was a little bit toothless, and I think it was trying to play both sides.
Corey, what did you think?
Boy, I hated it.
Why?
I haven't hated a movie that much and that intensely in about a decade. It really, to me, spoke to all the wrong, you know, all the dark, evil portions of our inner nature. And I think despite all of the claims from the filmmakers that this was some sort of political commentary or satire, taking the DC Comics universe and putting a movie that cynical and that bleak and that morally irresponsible under the label of a superhero film, which people come in with, you know, Cesar Romero is the Joker. Hey, they know this character. They love Batman. And this movie is just a receptacle of misery and bad feelings. And they reward the character's violence as the payoff. He becomes liberated by violence. And I think that's a really irresponsible message to put out in the world now.
I am so curious to see if the Academy liked this movie.
I can't imagine some of the older people liking this movie, but I don't know.
It got so many nominations, though, which was weird to me. It didn't feel like it was that good. And then it got 11 noms, I think. But well, I don't know
Joaquin
why.
Phoenix is incredible in this.
Yeah, he's good.
But he's always incredible. And there'll be another incredible performance to reward later.
But he did a better performance last year, and you were never really here. And he's playing almost the exact same type of a character, like a PTSD.
The Master.
He's done it better before. So now I think it's like you were saying earlier, it's like, let's reward them now for stuff they did like 3 years ago.
Kind of how the Oscars work.
Yeah, right. If you're just joining us, my guests are Michelle Kisner of SpoilerFreeMovieSleuth.com and Corey Hall, a critic with Metro Times and WDET, and we're talking about Oscar season, the films that made it, and the films that should have. Can we talk about some stuff that you liked and that the Society liked that the Academy glossed over?
Sure.
Sure. I was very into Uncut Gems. I feel like it was just completely snubbed, and I think part of why it was snubbed is that it's an unpleasant movie to sit through. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean that the movie 100% intends to be unpleasant, and it is.
This is the Safdie brothers film with Adam Sandler about a jeweler who is just involved in horrendous gambling debt and an even more horrendous sort of heist to try to make good on his financial situation.
Yes.
It's a very fast-moving film. People are saying a lot of amazing things about Adam Sandler's role, but just also the pacing and the way it cranks up the tension in this in this really difficult balancing act he's trying to hold on to.
And Adam Sandler is incredible in it, and I know he gets a lot of flack because he's Adam Sandler in the films he's done, which I don't have an issue with his comedy stuff. Like, it's whatever. It's, you know, fun. A lot of people have nostalgia for his older films. But he can put out a good performance given a good director. Punch Drunk Love, for example, he's fantastic in that. I mean, he has the capability. I actually saw an actor's roundtable with him where he said he didn't deserve to be sitting at that table. That's the kind of guy he is, that he doesn't think he's good enough. And I think he is. And I think this would have been a perfect chance for them to kind of like reward somebody that really went outside their box and tried and did a fantastic performance. And I think the movie itself just being so frenetic and anxiety inducing just makes people want to kind of write it off. People don't like movies that make them feel bad.
It feels more like a heist film than a quote-unquote serious film.
It is just nonstop tension. It is just, you will not have nails left on your fingers by the end of it. So for me, it was a little overwhelming in the one tone of it. Mm-hmm. Was oppressive a little bit. Yeah. That's why I didn't love it. But Sandler, you're right about if you get the right director. In Punch Drunk Love, Paul Thomas Anderson, and in here with the Safdie brothers, they took all the things Sandler does in a regular dumb comedy. Mm-hmm. And you made that into a real person, and that's terrifying.
Yeah.
If you met a guy that, like, wired up and angsty and you would be frightened. And in a comedy, you know, he's like, oh,
you wouldn't want to go hang out with this guy.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and in a movie, you know, he falls down the stairs and throws a beach ball off David Spade's head and everybody goes, ha ha. In this movie, you're like, that guy's creeping me out.
Yeah. It's about addiction, really, when it comes down to it. Addiction and how it destroys someone, and it can make them myopic to the degree that they disregard their own health, their other people's health around them. Like the film, I think also it's a little bit art housey, slightly, the way it's presented. The intro is very, like, you know, starts out in the cosmos and then it transitions in this other stuff. And there's like this kind of weird mystical quality about the gem that everybody's chasing, the so-called uncut gem from the title. The movie's just postmodern enough, I think, to where it's slightly off-putting. I think it's a little too weird for Oscar voters.
Corey, what was one of your favorites that was overlooked?
The Farewell, obviously, it was one of my favorites of the year.
Such a hilarious and charming film.
There was a great film called Last Black Man in San Francisco, which I really enjoyed. It's a gorgeously shot movie, just at least for the cinematography alone, and the performance is great in that. And I think Eddie Murphy in Dolomite Is My Name.
That was a Netflix original.
Would have been, but unfortunately, do it being Netflix. There's a lot of controversy going on with Netflix and their role in Hollywood. I would have liked sentimentally to see Eddie Murphy get a nod just for being funny again and being the Eddie Murphy that he used to be.
Yeah.
This performance, he really brings out all the things we used to love about him. And he does a great job. It's a dramatic actor in the film, too. Yeah. I would have liked to see
it. It's a love letter to indie filmmaking, too, which, you know, could use a little bit more attention. You know, we're in the age of the blockbuster and, you know, giant mega corporations owning, like, every studio, like Disney, you know. So I think that maybe could have got a little bit more love in that respect.
And it was about Rudy Ray Moore, who was this outsider who made what they, you know, when they used to call it blaxploitation genre. But that movie's a reminder that those movies were made for black audiences.
For people to watch.
By black filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And it chronicles that little moment in the 70s when people got to do wild things on their own outside of Hollywood's view.
Right. I noticed that the Detroit Critics Society also really liked Wesley Snipes in that film for his supporting role as one of the other directors.
It's another
in the
comeback where you're happy to see. Oh, where's Wesley Snipes been?
I was like, where's he been?
And he's he's really delightful in that movie.
Boy, you got the gift. Don't you never let nobody tell you can't be anything you want to be. You understand?
Yes, sir.
Rudy, come on. The film about to start.
Hey, Lady Reed, why don't you go on and watch the movie? I've seen it already. These people are going to be out here at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and they came to see Dolomite, so I'm going to give them Dolomite. All right?
All right.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about a film that I just loved. It's one of the weirdest films, and I sort of can't even believe it got a wide release, and that's Robert Eggers' The Lighthouse.
Yes. Absolutely loved it.
All black and white, fantastically weird piece with Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson as a couple of solitary lighthouse keepers. Mm-hmm. And I felt funny recommending this film to some people because it's really not for everyone. Yeah. But
you wouldn't tell your aunt to run out and see this one, maybe. But
if you can handle something a little weird,
unless your
horror,
aunt's hardcore. Maybe she's into it. But that is, I thought it was maybe a step or two too weird intentionally. It's in a Academy ratio, which is a box instead of a rectangle from the film presentation. And some of the touches, but Dafoe is
insane.
It's an insane performance.
From someone who kind of specializes in weird roles anyway.
Yeah. Yes.
It actually is fairly popular online, I've noticed, which when I first saw it, I was like, yeah, that's a CinemaScore F movie if I ever saw one. But and then when it came out, people loved it. It's just, I think people were kind of starving a little bit for something weird and offbeat like that.
Well, when you see something like Lighthouse or Uncut Gems, you're going to have an experience.
Yeah.
You don't always have that when you go to the movies. You might go, oh, well, that was pleasant, or you won't be moved by it.
This is Smash Mouth filmmaking.
Right. You can't escape these films. They're in your face, and they will make you feel something. Whether you like what you felt or not is the issue.
Could we maybe choose a few films from 2019 that we haven't mentioned so far that you just really wish people would stream tonight?
I believe this film is streaming on Hulu. It's called The Nightingale.
Yes, this was from the same filmmaker who brought us The Babadook.
Yes, Jennifer Kent, I believe.
Yeah,
is who
Australian filmmaker.
Yes, I think this movie got overlooked because it did actually play a little bit in 2018, like right at the end at a film festival. But it didn't get wide release till this year. It's a very brutal film.
Again, hard to watch.
We don't want no trouble.
That's just the way, isn't it? You don't want trouble, but sometimes trouble wants you.
I would like to give like a little content warning if you choose to watch this film. It is extremely brutal. It has sexual abuse in it, violence, if you're sensitive, that kind of thing. It's very intense. However, I don't think it's that way to be an exploitation film. I think it's that way to prove a point of a time in history when women were subjugated and where, you know, people didn't have the rights that they should, the Aboriginal population also. And I do like that it balances the main character who is white, but she's a female and she's being oppressed. But also it focuses on the Black people that were also being oppressed and kind of comparing and contrasting the different styles of oppression that can happen in that kind of environment. It's just extremely well made. But the subject matter was so horrific, I think, that people skipped it. But I believe it's on Hulu. And if you have the stomach for it, it's just a fantastically made film.
How about you, Corey?
I would say Slim and Queen. Or Queen
yes.
and Slim, excuse me. Queen and Slim got a little overlooked. It's kind of a Bonnie and Clyde, a fugitive story written by Lena Waithe. That's a terrific film that I don't think a lot of people saw. It deserved better.
Mm-hmm. Corey Hall, the Metro Times and WDET, and Michelle Kisner of SpoilerFreeMovieSleuth.com. Guys, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.
Still to come on the show, we talk with the new chief storyteller for the city of Detroit. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. We now continue our month-long look at Black art and Black artists in honor of Black History Month. And today, we have an actual work of art for your consideration. Detroit writer Desiree Cooper moved in with her elderly parents a few years ago to care for them through the crippling advance of dementia. Des recently read a short story about her experience on Stateside. But before we get to that reading, here she is talking about the first time her mother did not recognize Desiree as her daughter.
That's just a kick in the gut on a couple levels. First of all, that never stops being your mommy, and you're never not the daughter, the little girl. So to have your mother not recognize you as her child is awful. But here's the thing that got me most is that my mother's pride and joy, her aspiration, her vocation was motherhood. And she gave that 1,000%. So for her to look at a person that she gave birth to and raised and gave her all to and not recognize that person as the fruit of her, you know, literal labor and not recognize herself as the mother of that child was, whoa. I mean, she had not only forgotten me, she'd forgotten herself. And I almost just lost it. I mean, I've been at this now, and actually both of my parents have Alzheimer's. And so I moved in with them about 3.5 years ago. I left Detroit 30 years and moved in with them in the Virginia Beach area. And so it has been, you know, now I'm a little bit more hard-boiled, and the surprises keep coming. I guess I might just be a little bit more able to roll with what life is bringing now. That has been, I am a very type A person, and that has been slapped out of me in the last 3 years. There, you cannot be goal-oriented, task-oriented, what's going to happen, what's going to get done, and take care of two seniors with Alzheimer's at the same time. You have got to be a lot more zen about life. Yeah, so this is a piece of flash fiction that you will recognize is coming right out of my experience now, and it's called Waste Not. My parents are old and inert. Their bodies want only to be still. There's not much we can do for entertainment except sit here, and then for a change of scenery, sit there. When the weather is nice, and sometimes even when the rain is warm and gentle, I lift up the garage door and arrange the cushioned lawn chairs so that they can sit just inside the lip and watch the neighbors come and go. Sometimes we sip Cokes, sometimes we snack. Sometimes we have music, a little Motown or Boots Randolph to help us mark the time. But mostly we sit for hours and say nothing, or else listen to the rolling tide of my father's repetitious questions. I remember all those years when time was my enemy, invisible and cruel like gravity. It would barrel forward so furiously I had no idea where it went. As soon as I'd awaken, it would already feel blown. It passed in a gust of overwhelm. It had breath but no weight. It had seasons but no flavor. My parents and I are closer to the end of our lives than to the beginning. If anyone, we should know better than to throw away our uncertain measure that we have left. We should be scurrying and feathering, scrimping and stretching, but we aren't. Time now stretches languid in the humid afternoon, shimmering just above the hot asphalt. It tastes like caramel cake. It smells like pine needles in the rain. It looks like every second a different thing, as light goes a little higher, then lower, white, then yellow, then crimson, then indigo. We have learned something. Our days cannot be hoarded, only spent. And in these last luxurious hours, we are rich. We spend as much time as we want.
Detroit writer Desiree Cooper, she now lives in Virginia Beach with her elderly parents. A lot of us will be tuning in tomorrow for the showdown between the Spartans and the Wolverines on the basketball court. In between the sport ball and the well-written, exquisitely shot, expertly edited commercials in the breaks, take a minute to think about the way that ad industry culture shapes our understanding of the world. Do people see Colin Kaepernick differently through the lens of a Nike commercial? Has clever advertising by Apple opened up the door to an era of technology that we'd really want to trust with our personal information? And who could forget Chrysler's 2011 ad reminding America what the name Detroit means?
You see, it's the hottest fires that make the hardest steel. Add hard work and conviction and the know-how that runs generations deep in every last one of us. That's who we are. That's our story.
What would it look like if a city took its cue from the ad world? We wanted to talk to Eric Thomas about this. He has just joined the city of Detroit as its new chief storyteller and is most recently the principal of Saga Marketing. Eric Thomas, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you for having me.
What's the difference between the story of a product brand and the story of a city?
Nothing if they're done right. Storytelling is important because it's the way that we communicate. It's the way we share stories. And it's the way we remember things. And so if we tell stories that make people feel moved or inspired, then those are the stories that we should always tell.
Do you remember where you were when you saw that Chrysler commercial?
No. The Chrysler commercial is fine. I think people like it a lot. I think it's okay, right? I think it's an incredible commercial about Detroit, an okay commercial about a car. I think if you stuck anything in that commercial, it would have been fantastic. Because the story is Detroit, and the story of Detroit is of resilience and brilliance and of great people. And so anything you infuse with that story, I think will inspire delight and joy and confidence.
What aspects of Detroit's story do you think remain untold?
I think people forget that when you say grit, that grit is caused by friction. You cannot wear grit. You can only be ground into it. And so the stories that have not been told are the stories of the people who are heroes, who triumph because of their relationship with the people in the city and not just because it sounds good. And so there are so many hardworking, powerful, talented people in the city of Detroit, and I think that is not being told. I think we talk about Detroit in the context of this nebulous idea of hard work, but you forget to ask why there is hard work and also what is the history of the people that do the hard work and what is the result of that hard work. And so those are stories I think are not being told in the best way, but they can be.
That friction is a little easier to talk about when it comes at a remove of two or three decades. It's a little bit harder when you're thinking about that friction in terms of, say, overcharged property taxes or mass foreclosures or other matters that may paint the city in a less than flattering light. What responsibilities does the chief storyteller have to reflect the whole picture of the city?
So I think there's an important conversation about the context. Detroit is a result of systems, systems that are Detroit-based, county-based, state-based, and federal-based. It's also a city that is 80% black and 90% people of color. If people of color have been held down, then a city that is 90% of them will have the resulting impact of that systemic oppression. And so our job and my job is to make sure that people understand that the humans that live here in Detroit are more than their circumstance and greater than the individual stories of sadness that people like to tell about Detroiters. We need to shift to an asset-based conversation about Detroiters and their talent and their opportunities and the things that they do here. A story like mine is hard to happen anywhere else. A person who grew up low income, who doesn't have a college degree, who can work and fight and scrape and grow and present themselves in such a way to become the chief storyteller of that city. That is a much more common Detroit story than I think people realize. I am closer to Detroiters that you think that you shouldn't hire than I am to the ones that you think are quote-unquote acceptable.
Mm. When we think about the history of how storytelling and, you know, digital marketing have been used, there are plenty of examples of storytelling being used as a force for change. For example, the Occupy Wall Street movement. That wouldn't have happened if it weren't for the conversation going on through Adbusters magazine and other people who are involved in media and the ad industry. But at the same time, there are any number of examples where storytelling has been used to wash over uncomfortable truths. If the story of Detroit also includes overcharged property taxes and mass foreclosures, does the chief storyteller have a responsibility to reflect the whole picture?
My goal is not to act as an employee of the city of Detroit. My goal is to act as an ambassador for Detroiters. My job in the city is to not just bring the city's message to the residents, but to bring the residents' message to the city. I am the chief storyteller of the city of Detroit. The city of Detroit is the people of Detroit. It is important to remember that progressive movements, community movements, those voices must be amplified, not suppressed. Some of the greatest things in the world that we have, I mean, your vacation days are a result of unions standing up. Storytelling is not a new concept. It's just been packaged into something that's cute. Stories are how we tell our histories. It's how we connect to people. And so the stories about our struggles, but also our triumphs, have to be told. It is exciting that I have the opportunity to do that and to go in and really elevate Detroiters to the status of hero.
In your professional career, have you ever had to push back on a client?
All I do is push back on clients. I'm sure my clients are tired of me. it's because I believe in asset-based framing, and I've done all of my work in nonprofits. You know, this Sarah McLachlan, you know, fly on the head of his poor brown kid storytelling doesn't just feed into guilt. It frames how you understand the people. And so I push back all the time. We need to be reminding that we're not saving people. We're providing scaffolding for people who would otherwise be incredible contributors to society. And when you create that scaffolding, then that talent has the opportunity to shine. But the mental load of poverty and the mental load of oppression, the mental load of racism and the mental load of misogyny and patriarchy impacts someone's ability to have output. You take away those barriers and you see things that you've never seen before. I mean, even with those barriers, you have seen almost every style of art and music come almost directly out of the black community. And that's with the shackles. Imagine with those removed.
You wrote an article in the Free Press last November that noted Detroit is attracting an awful lot of people who may not know those stories of the city, white people who may enter the city, maybe even for their first time, and not stop to wonder why the spaces that they're drawn to are not equally welcoming to black people who were here well before the rebirth and the boom. What do you feel your work with the city can do about that?
So first, I think we get caught up in the black versus white thing, like there are not other people. There are a lot of people coming to Detroit.
including people of color.
Including people of color.
Right.
Who don't think about Detroit as a culturally black space. A black space that, by the way, we didn't make that way, right? That's redlining that created those demographics. There were jobs that moved out to the suburbs that we weren't necessarily able to get that created that. I mean, we didn't make Detroit a black city. People leaving made Detroit a black city. People creating areas that we couldn't move our families into because they didn't want us there made Detroit a black city. Detroit did not become a black city by happenstance. There was an intentionality that was created, and then it was disinvested in. That's the first part. But the second part is, because of that heritage, Detroit has a unique colloquialism, a story to tell, a particular swag, a particular drip that you should look to find. If you were going to Morocco, you would go look for Moroccan stories, right? You wouldn't go to Morocco and say, this needs to be a lot more like San Francisco, right? And so when you go to Detroit, you should come looking for Detroit. Who are those stories? Who are those people? When you go into a place that is less than 40% black in a city that is 80% black, you should start asking questions about what's going on here. I'm not saying the whole party needs to be black, but wouldn't it be weird if you showed up in Africa and didn't see any Africans? If I showed up in Birmingham and didn't see any white people, I would start asking some questions.
But how does the city's conversation have to do with?
It's about preservation. Uh-huh. It's about celebration, right? When you look at how the city's stories have been framed, we let corporations kind of do those things. The city is working hard to provide resources to Detroiters and not necessarily focus on the story of those resources. And so sometimes people don't know. We put the marketing dollars towards things we want people to buy. But I think it's time to start putting the marketing dollars towards ways we want people to feel about themselves so they take advantage of the resources and the opportunities that are available to them. And the things that are not available, then they get to push to make those things true.
A lot of people who've worked in the private sector for most of their careers have entered public service and found it a very different experience. Do you feel like you have the tools you need to do your job working for the city?
I have been the type of person to make weird things happen regardless of what is going on. Surviving in an area that's disinvested, going to schools that have been disinvested in, you know, getting nearly robbed in places and talking my way out of those things are much more frightening than having to deal with the bureaucracy of a public infrastructure. Every minute that I wait to help, you know, resource allocation is a day that people don't have the opportunities to thrive. And so to me, it sounds weird to complain about bureaucracy when there are lives at stake.
Do you expect you'll maintain a practice and some projects outside of your work?
Absolutely. Because a lot of the work that we do are focused on community. So we do a lot of nonprofit work. I'm not going to mention it because I don't want to cross streams. But the work that we do is focused on equity and community and housing and homelessness and all that other work. As much as I can do to help shape and frame those stories, I'll do it.
Do you know what your first project for the city is going to be yet?
Not necessarily. I'm working my way through a strategy to really help the city itself align. I believe in systemic change, and so I will work as hard as I can to have that kind of impact.
Eric Thomas, congratulations on the job, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
A less reported story coming out of Lansing this week. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has vetoed a bill that would let Michigan schools off the hook for heating small press boxes at outdoor sports facilities. The press boxes, where hardworking reporters sit to cover your high school games. This bill would have allowed schools in, say, Manchester, avoid having to meet certain codes for heat.
It's usually not until the end of the regular season into playoffs where you really start to deal with the sun goes down at 6 o'clock at night, winter chill sets in, it's 30 degrees at 9:30, and there's still a quarter left of football to play. And fingers get a little stiff when you're trying to type and it's that cold.
Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott covers high school sports in his spare time.
Football, a little bit of baseball and softball too.
Now, this is a tough one. We certainly can't see the point of keeping hardworking journalists warm. But seriously, do people who cover sports in our state's towns ever show up for work without a stormy cromer? Let us know what you think. You can reach us on Twitter at Stateside Radio or come say hi on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. We're going out today on some J. Dilla. Today would have been the hip-hop producer's 46th birthday. Detroit's own James J. Dilla Yancey died in 2006, but his impact on modern music is still talked about in the industry today. That's our show for this Friday. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. The show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio and a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you Monday.